Anzac Week draws to a close, we wanted to bring you a slightly different take on World War One, how it intersected with our universities. There's an Australian research project you may not know about called Expert Nation. To quote from its website, "Our histories of the First World War often focus on those who died. This project follows those who survived as they pursued their careers in the 1920s and 30s. It presents an alternate account of the importance of World War One to Australian nation building, one founded not on the battlefield of Gallipoli, but in the expansion and professionalisation of expertise." Expert Nation, we've found, is a large and fascinating-sounding database, and now, drawing on that database, a book of research into universities and the First World War has been published, which is a thorough surprise. It's co-edited by Melbourne University historian James Waghorn. James, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Good morning, Geraldine.
Just to set the scene, James, World War One happened to occur at a time when the professions were just emerging, weren't they, throughout the Western world?
That's right. It's a process under which the various university learned professions, as they were known, were establishing their authority, and they were doing so through government and achieving registration acts to ensure that they could exclude those who weren't so qualified. And they were doing so by achieving qualifications in the universities. And by World War One, I think the universities were mostly teaching students who were going to move into the professions. They saw themselves doing that right across the board.
And there were the professional associations rising. This is what I must say I found very interesting indeed, as a key part, really, of civil society.
Absolutely. That's right. And that went hand in glove with this process. Before the war, they were local state organisations, because the states were the ones that would enact these registration acts. They had their own local communities within the states. That was true also of the universities, which saw themselves very much as agents of their own states. And one of the changes brought by the war is a growing idea about a nation and Australia that was brought into the professions and their professional associations, which often formed national associations in the 1920s and 30s, but also the universities, which came to see themselves as Australian universities really for the first time.
And a quick snapshot, please, of which Australian universities existed at the outbreak of the war?
That's right. So there were six. By the First World War, there was a university in every state. So there were the three oldest universities at Sydney, Melbourne and Adelaide, followed by the state universities of Tasmania, Queensland and Western Australia. And Queensland and Western Australia had been established in 1909 and 1911, respectively, so just before the outbreak of the war. But they do have a national coverage by this point. And so that also helps to support these national movements.
And the ANU was quite a bit later, I think, wasn't it?
That's right. That's a product of, emerges after the after a long period of lobbying through the 20s and 30s, actually through this period, in 1946, yes.
Now, these universities provided expertise to the war effort, and we'll hear more about that in a moment. But they in turn benefited from a boost to their research capacities and particularly student numbers after the war.
Well, definitely. There are a couple of things. We've thought about the war in this project about it having three major influences on the professions. One was in the mobility of young men and women who went to theatres of war in Europe and the Middle East, and this exposed them to a whole lot of new ideas, perhaps ideas they'd read about but now were able to experience. And it also allowed them to establish international networks and also national networks that also helped to bolster the sharing of information. So federation may have happened in 1890, 1900, but that didn't mean that there was much contact between people from various parts of the country. Another aspect of the war was in the creation of new knowledge and expertise. Mm. As new methods were developed, there's a new training in different techniques that allowed professionals to become much more secure in their role. And the third was the role of government and bureaucracy. And the professions played an essential role in that, in various parts of the war bureaucracy. But also, as you've just alluded to, government also supported the development of the professions in Australia by the training of soldiers who had served.
They paid half their students, half the fees, didn't they, of students who served?
Right.
The repatriation department did.
They supported a number of them, a large number of them, to study in European universities, and then an even larger number who came back to Australia. The repatriation department covered half their fees and encouraged the universities to remit the remainder. So effectively they had a degree without having to pay for it. And this was immensely powerful, and it allowed individuals such as Sir Albert Coates, who became very prominent after the Second World War, a prominent surgeon before the Second World War, but well known now for his role on the Burma Railway as a surgeon. Mm. There's a statue in my town, Ballarat, of Albert Coates, who before the war was a very bright student but had gone into the Postmaster General's department after the war, drawing on these repatriation benefits, was able to gain his medical and surgical degrees and go on and assist Australia.
So who says government doesn't matter?
Government is intrinsic in this story.
Yes, quite clearly. But there is a very interesting other angle to this, because you point out recruitment for the war and assessment of the prospective soldiers meant that really for the first time, authorities had a close-up look at a whole sector of their population. It was a sort of a giant case study, and they were a bit concerned about what they found.
Well, that is absolutely the case. I think that the dental corps, as my colleague Tamsin Peach has written about, were absolutely horrified by the status of Australian teeth of enlistees. But more broadly, it's the process of bringing mass enlistment into a military force changed the way we thought about managing people, managing society. And while this did directly support developments in dentistry and developments in hospital treatment and things like that, it also helped, I think, it's a slightly long bow, but it does help for professions to conceive of the whole of society and think about how they might improve the lot, how they might assist with all sorts of things, and in public health and in education. Taking this social survey as the basis of their authority and their rationale.
Well, let's look, James, at the medical profession, which is your chapter in this book. They had the biggest participation of any of the professions.
Absolutely. It's striking in this book. We have 22 case studies, and it is striking how all different groups identify the war as a chemist's war, or as a dentist's war, or as an engineer's war. But in many ways, I think that medical enlistees also view themselves as a medical war. There are doctors serving all throughout in large military hospitals, all the way down to field ambulances right behind the front line. And they were actively involved throughout. The levels of sickness and illness, as well as wounded, was pervasive.
Yes, the sickness part of it. I think we think of injuries as the main need in war, but in fact it was sickness.
The mortality is often much larger to do with sickness, illness, as well as people dying from wounds, rather than death in battle. And so this meant that the medical officers were intrinsically involved at all levels of the military machine. They were involved in the assessment of recruits, as you identify. They're then involved in assessing whether and when soldiers can return to the front. It's a very harrowing business. And also, after the war, of course, they are the ones who determine who is eligible for invalid benefits, whose conditions are sufficient. And the fact that they were professionals was essential for this.
And then that all led to the specialisations, didn't it, within medical care, which were developing anyway, but very much accelerated by the war.
That's right. Partly this is about the growth of the number of medical professionals, but also it is, absolutely, it's about the growth of research and postgraduate work at universities, and also the developments in things like surgery. And so through the 20s and 30s in Australia, there's an enormous upswing in the number of people who identified, doctors who identified as specialists, and they had specialist training. They then formed their own specialist professional associations associated with the larger BMA, the Central British Medical Association. Mm. And so,
look, I'm just aware of the time because I want to get to from health to economics, another profession which really only got going in the early 20th century. Not only your contributor Anne Rees says after the 1920s Wall Street crash, which is the popular wisdom, she says it was World War One and its aftermath which really brought economics into the public eye.
Anne Rees wrote a terrific chapter in this book and really worth reading. She talks about the way in which the profession of economics emerged from a kind of infancy associated with the social sciences, political economy, essentially emerging out of the Bachelor of Arts, which is concerned with rhetoric, logic, interpretation of events, knowledge of the way in which events happen, how they transpire, into something more of a science. And the war was essentially in that the war required planning, required guidance about how they were going to fund the conflict, how they could boost production. And this was also something, I must say, that business was clamouring for at the same time. And so individuals such as Douglas Copeland, who was very significant, including at ANU, the first Vice-Chancellor later, is working at understanding and interpreting society and social events in those economic terms about the movement of money, about production, consumption, and so on. And that the war was very important in the rise of the Commonwealth government and in economic planning created a new need that the universities responded to and created enormously successful commerce faculties and economics faculties across the country.
So interesting, and we don't have time to go into the way journalism was another one of the areas. We'll have to leave that. There's just so many facts in this book that it quite surprised me. So James Waghorn, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Geraldine. It's a pleasure.